And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and today guest host Blake McVeigh will be talking to Adrienne Berard about her book, Water Tossing Boulders, which is published by Beacon Press. It's the true story of the Chinese-American Lum family, who fought for the rights of their daughters to attend whites-only public schools in 1920s Mississippi. Their case made it all the way to the Supreme Court 30 years before the landmark Brown v. Board of Education.
Adrienne, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today. So, Water Tossing Boulders. Tell us how you came upon this story.
It began as an effort to track my own family history in the Mississippi Delta. So that's where it started. Of course, it evolved into a story about a Chinese immigrant family. My family is not Chinese American. I'm really generations of Southern, poor, white, sharecropping families. I go back 7 generations in the Mississippi Delta. So I was trying to write a book about the women in my family that I had grown up with and learned about as a child. So I went to an archive at Delta State University, which is in Cleveland, Mississippi, to uncover more about my grandmother, who actually lived across the street. So I thought maybe when she passed away, some of her belongings wound up across the street at the archive. They didn't. It was a very thin bit of research there on my own family. But I did bump into the history and the legacy of the Mississippi Delta Chinese. And that was entirely by accident. There was a meeting there of a group of people who were trying to preserve that history by collecting archival material, interviews, and that eventually became a museum, which is now the Mississippi Delta Chinese Heritage Museum. But I was there for one of the first meetings and just happened to be digging through the archives at the same time that they had one of their very first meetings. And from that conversation with them, with Frida Kwan, who now lives in Memphis, at the time, she was back and forth between Cleveland, Mississippi and Memphis. And she talked to me about what it was like being Chinese in Cleveland. The second I had a conversation with Frida, I knew right away that there was a much bigger story about the immigrant experience in the Mississippi Delta. And I immediately changed course. It was one conversation and my whole book was scrapped, which my publisher was not super excited about. But it became a real journey into a world I didn't know or understand. First, having grown up largely in the North and also really having no understanding of what the immigrant experience was like in the 1920s in the U.S., it was just overwhelming to walk into the Lum family story and learn what they did and what a huge step it was in American history. And I have no idea why this book wasn't written before I got there, to be honest.
Is that to say that no other work of any kind has been done on this story? Are you blazing a trail with this?
I am, quite by accident. I didn't expect myself to write the first book about this Supreme Court decision, but I happened to be the first to write it. I hope there's a lot of other books about the Chinese experience in the South and in Mississippi Delta specifically. But for right now, this was really the first work on this court case and on the Lum family and really honing in on the personal family experience of being a Chinese immigrant in the segregated South. There are plenty of works about the immigrant experience in the southern United States, but not the Chinese experience and not in the Mississippi Delta and not told through their voices in a way that I really wanted this book to be about. It's their story. It's their family history. So I kept a very small presence as the omniscient narrator. I really let them speak, use their letters, use their voices, their family history to tell the story, because in the end, it's history, but it's also a personal decision that they made, one decision at a time. They didn't think they were revolutionaries, I don't think. I think this was the type of thing that they went one small decision, one step at a time, all the way through this whole 3-year court battle.
At certain points, the story seems so personal and so detailed, such as when the father was crossing the frozen river into America, or the mother being so upset about how the children were treated for that time in Michigan. Did you get those details from the family?
Partially. So this is a challenge. First, I don't have any experience as a historian either. So here is a journalist who's a decade in the field of journalism, no experience as a historian, trying to write a piece of narrative nonfiction. So what I started with was the family. But judging from my own efforts to chronicle my own family, I know how over the years stories change. So I reached out to probably 15 members of the family of all generations. I tracked them down throughout the United States. Some are in California, some are in Florida, some are in Houston. So that was a big effort just to track that down, personal story by personal story. And then I would cross-reference them. And whenever they said somebody traveled somewhere, I thought there could possibly be a record. So any time that I could match, and I got help with a lot of historians helped me on this because I really didn't know what I was doing. So I called people much smarter than I am to get help tracking and verifying all of these stories they told me. But when I had probably about 7 members of the family tell me the same story about the father immigrating illegally to the United States over the frozen Detroit River in the early 1900s, probably 1905, 1904, there was something about 7 people telling me the same story that made me think, okay, this could be true. So I actually went to Chicago, which is where the immigration records for Detroit are. And I thought, if there's any record of this happening, the Immigration Service may have kept a tally or at least some kind of record of people making this crossing. Sure enough, I had a very detailed description of almost the exact same time he would have been crossing, of a whole series of immigrants coming in by crossing the frozen river. Many of them didn't survive. So some of the records that were there were saying, well, we need to pass this on to an investigator to look into how many deaths there have been because people have been falling through the ice. And then you go to the files that should have the investigations. Nothing was done. So part of that is just getting the family story and backing it up with the records that I could pull. And in fact, I actually quote directly from one of those records at the start of that chapter because I really wanted to show that this has been verified. People were making this crossing in the dead of night across a frozen river to get to the United States.
So you mentioned talking to several family members. How were you received by them? Did they seem eager to talk about this?
What's interesting is that population of people, which they are scattered throughout the country, who were pulling together this museum at the time that I was working on the book, they knew of the Lum family, and it was this sort of legacy that they kept, the story that they told, but the Lum family was not involved in that museum process at all, which for me, I thought this could be a red flag that they don't want any part of this history. They are moving on. They eventually lost the court case. It's not a victory for them. They don't want to be part of preserving this history. But I was able to get one of them, Sharon Lum, on the phone first. She's in Houston, and somebody had gone to church with her. Someone else I had been researching and working with. And they said, just give her a call, see what she says. And right away, she was super excited. And she reached out to everybody else in the family. And sure enough, I'm getting phone calls from California, from Florida. Everybody's calling me up saying, I have photos. I heard this story. Somebody sent me this. And for a lot of them, they really didn't know the bulk of the case. They had heard stories about a court case, but they had no idea how far it went, that it went all the way to the Supreme Court, that the family fought for 3 years to get this decision that eventually worked against them. But they had no idea generations later that it was as big of a deal as it was. In fact, one member of the family in retirement decided she wanted to study law, and this case showed up in one of the textbooks. It was about a paragraph. And she said, I think that's my grandfather's name. Sure enough, it was. So it's those kind of little family stories that I was pulling together for 4 years, just getting on the phone with this scattering of people. They actually held a reunion, which was great. So I could get everybody in the same room and do interviews where they could bounce ideas off of each other, because that's really helpful in research. And eventually it got to the point where I could send them an early manuscript of the book. And that's when I was a little nervous because there's a couple things that don't show the family in the greatest light. Mostly they're shown as a family, which is, you know, they have their own flaws. But some things like the mother was pregnant before she married the father. The family didn't actually know that when I sent them the manuscript, so I thought it would become a much larger scandal. But the facts were the facts, and one after another they would call, and one of them came to Mississippi to visit me to tour the courthouse where the case started. It was really a powerful experience. I think that was the most rewarding part for me, is to give the family their history back, because now they have this story, and before they really didn't, so they can own it, and they are. They're ordering books for every person they meet now, so it's great. I think it went over well, but I was very nervous about it.
So you must feel vindicated that everything went so smoothly and that they received it so well.
Well, it's nice, you know, you crawl around in somebody's attic for 4 years. They want to know what you're doing there. So in the end, to send them a finished manuscript and say, I promise that me picking your brain about whatever perfume your great-grandmother once wore actually got us somewhere. We have a story to tell. And all of that comes after years. I mean, I was really working for about four and a half years on just the research. So this is me going back and forth with them for a long time. So to come back with a product really meant a lot to me, to show them, hey, I haven't just been twiddling my thumbs here, and all of this innocuous stuff I was asking is actually filling out your family story.
When you started this project, did you have an inkling about how timely the subject would be given the current political climate?
I had no idea this book would become so timely. In fact, when I was trying to get a contract, I had so many publishers turn me down. I got a lot of rejections before Beacon decided to pick up the book. They said, we're going to have trouble justifying this. This is 5 years ago. We're going to have trouble justifying why this is relevant now. So that was one of my biggest hurdles, was to explain to the publishers why it was relevant 5 years ago. So I was able to make some ties, but again, even the publication date, we wanted the book to come out before the election, because even my publisher was thinking, well, Clinton will win the election, and then all of this rhetoric about immigration will go away. So we want to make sure that your book comes out in October before we have any election results in November, and that way you can get at least a month of talking points. And here I am,
wow.
Months later, and this really is still top of mind, and there's just a lot in this book that now is verbatim coming out in a lot of rhetoric on both sides of the aisle, which is really interesting to me. You know, the idea that immigrants are somehow a threat and that they should be monitored, we need to do more to restrict immigration, those kind of ideas, especially rising up among the white working class, was so exactly what was happening when this case started in 1924. I mean, we're talking about a reflection that you can map verbatim on some of the rhetoric in the speeches that I quote in the book, I hear again and again now. So it's history kind of circling back around on itself, which 5 years ago I couldn't have predicted. But now, you know, it's so much more timely, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Right.
As I'm sure a bookseller is happy that it's so timely right now.
So it's almost like this book was published for an alternative universe.
Yes.
So as you were doing your research and as you came across a treasure trove, I guess, of potential stories, did you consider focusing on other stories, or was it pretty clear from the beginning that this was the one, the Lum family story, that was what you wanted to focus on?
I would have loved to focus on maybe a few other stories. I've spoken with the Lum family. They're amazing people. I'm really glad I got to tell this story of all stories. But the key thing that drew me into it was, one, you know, the sheer boldness of the family to even bring this case in 1924. But as a historian, to have the records of the court case makes the narrative a lot easier to write. So I knew there would be transcripts. I knew I would have dates. I would have letters. I would have records. I wanted people to read it with their feet up, that it would feel like fiction. I don't want it to feel like a textbook. So that meant that I needed a natural narrative structure, which a court case provides. So even though they didn't get the verdict they wanted, they didn't win the case all the way through it, I have the letters that were sent between lawyers, I have all of the transcripts, I have every brief that was filed, so I have a lot to work with in terms of archival material, which had I decided to tell another story, which I in the beginning was interested in doing, I wanted to actually talk about multiple families, it just wasn't possible because you just don't have that archival record in the same way that this court case had it.
Do you feel you will revisit any of that material for work in the future?
I've been toying with the idea of a second book, but about the next generation. So about Martha, Berta, and Bisco, the children. They came of age during the Depression when Martha became of age to go to college. So she actually never went to college, which was her dream, which is what they were fighting for in the court case, to get her into school. And the Great Depression hit right as she's ready to attend college. So their generation is fascinating to me because they have the Great Depression going into World War II. And that period of time to be a Chinese immigrant in Mississippi is just as fascinating as the 1920s being kind of a third race in a binary racial society. So that experience for them too, especially those three children, the two girls went out to California and were Rosie the Riveters. Visco went to China and served during World War II as a medic. So he went back. He was in northern China. His family's from southern China. So he saw a different part of the country. Mm-hmm. But still, he's, you know, part of a world that his family comes from. But going as an American to fight the Japanese, as a Chinese American. And the family kept his war journal. So there's just a lot of material still there on the children. So I still have all of that. And I'm working on how to maybe do a second book that would follow up where the family went from this verdict on.
As you were doing the research, did you spend any time in Rosedale to see the general store or any of the other places, the school?
Every time I had writer's block, I would just drive down Highway 8, you know, a couple miles, probably 20-minute drive if I was speeding, which is easy to do in the Delta. It's all flat.
Yeah.
And it was, yes, I spent a lot of time in Rosedale, Mississippi because there's so much of the landscape that's still there. That general store that they managed is still there. It's all falling apart. It's really kind of a place forgotten. Rosedale's come under a lot of financial hardship, and so many people have left, and those who remained really just can't get out. So it's abject, abject poverty. But because of that poverty, it's kind of a sick little coincidence that because there hasn't been an effort to revive Rosedale, the buildings are all still there. So I would take the old fire insurance maps that came out in the 1920s, and I could walk around holding those maps and know exactly. I could walk the same path that the daughters walk. That's why I was able to recreate those scenes so well, is because all of those buildings are still there in the same layout, same materials that they were in the 1920s. They have, you know, ivy growing up the sides of them, and some of them have roofs that have collapsed. But the buildings themselves, even the school itself, are all still there. So it's walking through the ghosts of history, literally, as you're walking around Rosedale with those old maps.
I want you to talk for a minute about Governor Brewer and the level of risk that you felt like he took during that time to take on such a controversial case.
So at the time that they wanted to integrate the white school, which I should clarify that the two daughters in this family, one daughter became the voice of the court case, and that's because she was a straight-A student. And if they were casting someone, she would be the perfect person to cast as the perfect idyllic child who just wants to go to school.
Right.
Berta was much more rebellious. She got into fights. She had quite the record. So she was not going to be the person you put at the front of this case. But in September of 1924, which is right after the U.S. had passed really huge restrictions on immigration, based into racial quotas, where people are from and how they can get here, the Chinese being the most restricted. This is just months after. These two girls are kicked out of school, and the parents decide we're going to fight the school board. They couldn't find anyone, even the Chinese, to support their case. No one. And they had attended the Methodist Church. They were well tied to the power class. And so first it was a huge risk for the family, because even the person who owned their home, right, their landlord, was part of that upper crust white society, had been on the school board, helped funded the school. So it was a huge risk for them. But they couldn't get any kind of financial support to bring this case, let alone any kind of solidarity. And they did it anyway. And they found a lawyer in Clarksdale, Mississippi, this ex-governor Earl Brewer, who would take the case pro bono. Which doesn't, honestly, even now looking back in it, I'm thinking, why would someone risk their career like that unless they had absolutely nothing to lose? And I don't think the governor had, at that point, anything left to put on the line. He had lost a ton of money in the cotton crash. So the Great Depression actually hit the Mississippi Delta first. Because there was just this terrible cotton crop, and all of his money was invested in cotton. So he had lost all his money. He had recently lost a race for the Senate. So he had nothing to put on the line. He was the laughingstock of even his own community. No one voted for him in his own hometown. So when the Lum family comes to him and says, we want to fight this case, I can just picture him being like, I want to fight too. He'd had enough of the same power structure that they had. The same people had raked him over the coals just months before during the election. So he was ready to fight as much as they were. Even so, it was a huge risk for him, physical risk for him. You know, this is the peak of the resurgence of the KKK. We're talking about lynchings, houses being burned down. He could have risked his life, his family's life, by taking this case. And I think he genuinely thought he could win was another reason he took it. And if he could go up against the Supreme Court of Mississippi at the time, I think that was his ultimate goal, was to go back to his old stomping grounds in Jackson, Mississippi, where he was once governor, and defeat this very structure that had been pushing him down for so long. It didn't turn out that way, but I think had he thought he could win, were I him and thought I could win, I would really, really at that moment in time want to, because it would almost be a vindictive act to fight back at that point.
In your research, did you ever come across anything that indicated that maybe he was more dedicated to silencing his critics than to championing the cause of the Lum family?
He's a complicated character. I should clarify, he's a politician, right?
Right.
So there's always multiple gears working with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot about his thinking, his routine, one, because all of his letters from his governorship were kept. So I know more about him than any other person in the book. His daughters were also journalists, which helps. So they kept track of everything. I mean, his calisthenic routine, which I include in the book, was something they made note of. And his logic, which at some points was deeply flawed, but he had a really deep dedication to the Christian faith. And he believed in divine justice. He quotes the Bible, he quotes Job over and over and over again when he's a governor. And that puts him at odds with a lot of people, because he's saying, well, this is what the right thing to do is. When I have my final moment, I want to be able to tell God I did the right thing at the right time. And he's telling people this who are, you know, committing vast abuses against people in the name of earning money for the state of Mississippi through all of its penitentiary cotton franchises. And here he is going up against that. So part of it, I think, is he may have just genuinely thought this is the right thing to do. This is a choice that somehow is godly in a way. It could also have been very calculated. He was a super bright man, and he could have said, well, this will put me in the limelight again. Here I am, the laughingstock already. I've lost this run for Senate, but I can get to the front pages of the newspaper again, and I can use this as sort of my bully pulpit, right? I can say all of these things in the courthouse that maybe I couldn't say in my stump speech. So that could have been part of it as well. I don't have too much in terms of what his thinking was at the time. I just have the drafts of the case. So I know he really started with the 14th Amendment, which tells me, okay, he's thinking about equal protection of the laws. He's thinking about justice for every person. And that 14th Amendment really says, well, it's, you know, after the 13th, which is emancipation. So, and you follow it up with the 14th, which is basically saying the laws apply to everyone. And so for me, knowing that he started his drafting of this case with the 14th Amendment tells me there's some seed of it that's good, right? That he believes that every person deserves certain things. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the tragedy of the case is that 14th Amendment, first he hands off the case, right, when it's the most important time of the case, which is when it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. So clearly he wasn't super, super invested in the Lum family. But when that gets moved and handed to a novice of a lawyer, that 14th Amendment gets switched around completely, and it becomes every person has the right to segregate themselves versus every person has the right to equal facilities, equal rights to the same education. It becomes, well, every person has equal rights to segregation, to keep themselves away from other races. And that's the real tragedy of the case, is I think had he kept it, it may have stayed as he originally intended in those first early briefs, and instead it became the exact opposite over the course of really one fall.
Talk a little bit about why Governor Brewer passed the case on.
He experienced a lynching right outside the door to his home. essentially. He lived a few blocks from the courthouse. And there was a wealthy planter whose chief manager was murdered in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is where Earl Brewer lived and had spent his entire career. He was the defense attorney. He was there all the way through his entire career as a lawyer. So we're talking decades here within the same courthouse. And they found a whole series of black sharecroppers guilty for this offense, for the murder of this planter manager. One of those people was a young man who had served in World War I, and he actually wore his uniform to court for that hearing. He was the only one to continue to say, I'm innocent. Other people took pleas. They were granted their lives. This young man, his name was Lindsey Coleman, he kept saying, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. I have an alibi. I wasn't there, I wasn't there, I wasn't there. Finally, the jury finds him not guilty, which was huge because he was risking his life by going to a jury over and over and over again saying, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. As he's walking out of court, he's picked up by a band of men. They throw him in the back of a car and they toss him on the street and shoot him. Kill him right there in broad daylight in front of the courthouse, between the courthouse and Earl Brewer's home. I think that shook him to his core. It's right in his front yard. I mean, this is like, he's a man who really believes in justice. And here is this huge violation of justice happening on his doorstep. So this is right before he's supposed to take the case to the Supreme Court. And instead, he decides he's going to figure out who these men were, and he's going to prosecute them. He hasn't been a prosecutor in a very long time. Mm-hmm. But he decides to kind of go back into that role and bring a case against what eventually would be five men for the murder of Lindsey Coleman. In doing so, he hands off the Gonglum case. So part of it, it's a noble cause that he takes on. He's the first person to ever try white men in the murder of a black man in Coahoma County, which is a really big deal.
Right.
But he passed up an opportunity, a huge opportunity, to argue the Lum family's case to desegregate schools in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
So in actuality, it was a pretty difficult choice he made.
I think it was. But it was also immediate. I mean, were I in his shoes, and I did this a lot in the book, I literally walked where he walked.
Right.
I walked the path that he would have walked from his house to his law office to the courthouse to be able to get a sense of, were I here at this time and this happened right here, what would I do? You know, I'm not him.
Right.
I don't have any idea how he was thinking. But it was helpful to think, okay, here I am standing where he would have stood. He was the one who met with the medical examiners to see the bullet holes in the uniform. That he was looking at the body. He was reading the medical examiner's report. That's so immediate. Whereas, you know, you have miles away in D.C., you're supposed to argue this obscure 14th Amendment case for this family, that you're actually doing this for free.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was very front of mind for him. Here he is in front of this body. That the sense that he has for justice, I could just see that overwhelming everything else because it's so immediate and it's right there where he spent his entire career really fighting for the court as a pillar of the society, right? That law and order is, he means it. It's very valuable to him that when people commit crimes, they are prosecuted, they serve their time. So for people to get away with murder in front of his house, in front of his court where he's worked his whole life, I don't think he would have stood for that.
So in a way, it's kind of hard to argue with his reasoning.
It's hard to argue with reasoning when you're looking back so far. So, right, like my 20th century mindset,
right.
Arguing, oh, we made this decision in 1926. How could you?
Right.
But in my perspective today, I know how much of a flawed brief was submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court. I know how much of a failure that lawyer made, all of the different mistakes he made throughout the entire brief that lost the case. But he didn't know that. He was handing it off to a friend. He thought, this will be in good hands now. And you can't know in advance what the result of history is going to be. You're just making the best decision you can at the time.
If I remember correctly from your writing, this lawyer was not even a trial lawyer.
He was a lawyer for the railroads. He had always been a corporate lawyer. He had never argued a 14th Amendment case in his career. So he had no understanding of the bulk of what this case was about. I mean, he misused the Equal Protection Clause multiple times in different ways. In fact, he cited Plessy v. Ferguson, which created the institution of segregation itself. Well, the institution was there, but really, you know, right. solidified it. He cites that as reason for why Martha should be allowed to integrate the white school. So he had a total misunderstanding of what it was he was supposed to be doing. So I don't know where the wires got crossed in there, but somehow he brought something to the Supreme Court that gave it the authority to basically tell Mississippi and any other Southern school, do whatever you want. Segregate your schools as you see fit. Determine the race of students however you see fit. If you see an immigrant kid and you want them to go to the black school, go for it. That was how this was interpreted. The brief that he submitted was basically taken and said, well, you know what? Mississippi's in its right. Onward and upward, Mississippi.
Right.
And you see it in Brown v. Board. This was the hugest hurdle for them to get over when they finally had to argue that in 1954, because it's such a broad stroke. It doesn't just say, oh, you can segregate schools as you see fit, but you can determine the racial makeup of your schools however you want to. And any state, that's a precedent that says for any state in the country to say, you know, carte blanche, do what you feel like, the federal government won't step on your toes.
Did you detect any malice or any of that intention in your research with the second attorney? Or do you think it was simply a matter of bungling?
I think it might have been a combination of both. I don't think he realized the opportunity that he was given. So bungling, however you want to call it, he really dropped the ball. And part of that, I think, is because his priorities weren't where ideally they should have been. So I'm sure he had plenty of other well-paying briefs he could have written for the railroads, and he kept doing that. And then in his spare time, he cobbled together whatever he could for this and passed it off, and that was it. So it wasn't top of mind for him. And it should have been. If they were going to argue the case, they actually should have done it in person. They submitted it all on brief and just sort of mailed it up there and said, well, this is the best we can do. So they didn't even take the opportunity to see the justices face to face and argue the case, which they had the opportunity to do. They were given that. In fact, they were getting multiple letters from the clerk of the Supreme Court saying, well, when are you coming up? We can accommodate you. And he would say, oh, not right now. Can't do it right now. Can't do it right now. Can we delay some more? And eventually he said, well, this is the best I got. Sent up a brief that was terrible. And that was all that would argue for the Lum family. In the end, that's all they had.
Did Brewer have choice of other lawyers to pass this off to?
I mean, he had plenty of people. He was not well-liked, like I said. He's not well-liked within Mississippi as a whole. So he didn't have too many friends or allies by the time he took the case. This was a little bit of a gift to Flowers, who was the J.N. Flowers who took the case. Because Flowers released a whole giant file on lynching in the South. It's actually a beautiful piece of research. He went through archives of newspapers. So right as this lynching is happening, right, that Earl Brewer is trying to prosecute, this J.N. Flowers releases this whole study on lynching and how pervasive it is throughout Mississippi and how many lives have been lost and what that means for the state and how can it reconcile the fact that it loves law and order but it tolerates such brutal lynchings throughout the state, which was a progressive thing to do. And he signed it, the Law Society of Mississippi. So he basically said the Mississippi Bar is against lynching, which was a huge step. So part of me thinks, and I couldn't totally confirm this, but I do know that they could have been working together, right? Okay, well, you release this study from the Mississippi Bar Association at the same time that I'm trying to prosecute, and I'll give you this case and a chance to argue in front of the Supreme Court. It could have been a little bit of a quid pro quo, but I couldn't nail it down. I didn't find any letters to really substantiate that.
Back to the book itself. Everything that I have read, reviews and the like, they've all been glowingly positive. How has your experience been about people's reactions to the work?
I was very nervous about how people would react to the book. I didn't expect to get as many positive reviews, especially when I was first sending out manuscripts to authors who I really admire their work. I've grown up reading their work. So to send an early first book to them, I was extremely nervous. And part of it, too, is that it's written in a way that's very novelistic. It's almost like fiction, but it is nonfiction. I mean, I worked very, very hard. The footnotes are larger than the book itself. But part of me thinks when you read something like that, and it's so easy to read, and there's scenes are recreated, there's a lot of ways you can poke holes in it. And especially as a first-time author, that was my biggest concern, is somebody's going to be able to poke a hole in this. I want to make sure that the entire book is rock solid. I can say that I know that this flower grew on this plot of land at this time. So a lot of the research that I went into it was what I was hoping would stand up. So far, I haven't had any complaints about holes in the facts itself are fine, and those are solid. And that was the biggest concern that I had, is that there may have been a way that I had messed up some kind of little fact. Even as, you know, as tiny as it seems, I really needed even the weather to be perfect.
Tell us about the L. Anthony Lucas Award.
I should credit them for the entire book, actually. So while I was working on the manuscript, they offer, it's a joint award that's given through Columbia University and Harvard University's, their journalism schools. And it's $30,000 for a work of nonfiction that is in the process, right? So it's just the early stages, but the author doesn't have the funds to complete the work. And it's supposed to help them. And it's anyone who's writing a book in any given year, as long as it's nonfiction. So the competition was really high. So when I was called and told that I was awarded this book, I was actually working part-time at a restaurant and waiting tables. And I got the call while I had a whole handful of dishes. I immediately put them down. I was like, oh, my shift's over. I can get to work, because I was able to take some time away from just making ends meet and spend a full 2 years on the book, because $30,000, I was living in Manhattan at the time, so I moved down to Mississippi, because $30,000 in Mississippi will get you through a long period of time.
Yes.
So I was able to ride out 2 years on that grant, and it allowed me to throw myself, which is a luxury, to throw yourself into a book completely. So I was living in this world for 2 years and doing nothing else. I mean, this was my life, was this family and their journey, which as a first-time author is a huge luxury, which I understand. You really are often juggling a book project on top of 20 other things you're trying to handle. And I was just lucky enough to get this award and be able to focus all my energies on getting this story right.
What are you working on now? What comes next?
I'm juggling a couple things. I'm now working as an editor of a local newspaper, which is great because I started as a local news journalist, and going back full circle now managing a full newsroom is super exciting. So that keeps me pretty busy. But being plugged into local news, I'm really excited about working in daily journalism in this day and age, and being tapped into local communities and how they make change and all of the little moves that happen to create a full little mini society, all of these working gears that happen. And I'm just now getting back into it after a decade of being away from it. So that I'm loving. I live in Williamsburg, Virginia, and it's right next to Jamestown. So I've been doing a lot of work with the archaeologists there, and there's a project they're working on, which I will not disclose at the moment, but I've been talking with them about it, and I would love to really get my hands into what they're working on and tell a history of not just what they're finding, but how they're finding it and sort of how history is made and uncovered at the same time as telling the history itself. So kind of a multiple narrative story I would love to do, maybe possibly as a next book, although I'm not sure where I'll find the time now, of, you know, the study of history being captured as well as the story of the history itself.
Sounds like you have your hands full.
Very busy.
Before we wrap this up, is there anything else that you feel that we haven't covered that you would like to say a few words about?
I would just like to say I love the work that you do. This is really a fascinating place, the library, and just what it gives to the community is huge. I had no idea that you had these kind of resources here in Memphis, and I wish, were I living in the Mississippi Delta still, I would be making regular trips up here. It's really kind of incredible. My husband's a librarian, so I always have to plug the library, and just even being in the Delta, so many librarians helped me through this process of getting a work of nonfiction out there. I never would have been able to do it with the help of so many archivists and librarians, and really, they're the unsung heroes of this profession. I thanked a lot of them in the back of the book, especially my husband, because he put up with me both as a wife and as a researcher. But it's really been just an incredible process to get to know what kind of resources are available publicly to anyone through just the process of writing this book.
Well, it's great to see authors and journalists allied with librarians. And to be explicit about it, because I'm sure there are a few more natural connections than between those groups. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Adrienne Berard is the author of Water Tossing Boulders, How a Family of Chinese Immigrants Led the First Fight to Desegregate Schools in the Jim Crow South, which is published by Beacon Press. Blake McVeigh was your host today. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, wiplfmbooktalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.